Hello, I'm Claire Tonti and welcome to Tonts, a podcast about feeling all of it. This week, I talked to comedian, documentary maker, producer and podcaster Sam Peterson, or Sammy P. I first met Sammy at a party and he seemed just so warm and funny and full of confidence and stories. Listening to his podcasts or meeting him in person, you would never guess the story he's about to tell about his life and how he became who he is. It's a reminder that everyone has a story and you just never know what really is going on in someone else's head. I'll also say that the other reason I wanted to talk to Sam is that everything he has achieved, from making docos to stand-up comedy to producing and writing, has all been through sheer determination and hard work. He's self-taught and I think is such a great example of what you can do if you rally a hell of a lot of elbow grease, put fear to the side and just get on with making it. Just make the thing. Make mistakes, pick yourself up and keep going. Putting aside some of those excuses that we give ourselves about why we can't do the things that we really want to do. And the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, that we're too shy or, I don't know, not good looking enough or not clever enough or funny enough, or that we could never achieve what we really want to achieve because we just don't have the time. I think Sam is such a great example of someone who just overcomes so many things in his life to just get on with making stuff. And I just would love you to listen to this conversation. And I think, remember that we're all in this together. Absolutely. And we all have a story to tell. All right. Here is Sammy P.
Hello, Sammy P.
Hello, Claire Tonti.
Oh, you're here. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. Very good. I got a coffee. Good. Got a little bottle of water.
Oh my gosh, you were waiting for me. I was late.
So many beverages. Oh, I don't care at all.
So many beverages.
I don't plan to ever do anything by myself. So when I have like a time to have a time, when I have a hell of a time, when I have a
when
coffee
I have
or anything.
A hell of a time.
When I have a coffee or anything by myself, it's just like the most luxurious thing in the world.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. The drive here was my luxurious time alone.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful.
Yeah.
I have two children.
Oh, yeah. It's like when someone cancels plans and you're like, that's so great. Thank you.
I know.
Like someone's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I can't make his drinks. And you're like, great.
Excellent. Oh, my gosh. Well, speaking of time, that's great. I'll start there.
Yeah.
You do so many things. And I was trying to figure out how you do all the things that you do, because you podcast and you write and you do like comedy films and a documentary, plus you work full time in a marketing job.
Yeah, I do.
Like full time.
That's
assuming.
eight till 5:30 Monday to Friday. Yeah.
Gracious.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? How do you approach time management?
I always give myself really harsh deadlines, which is ridiculous when you do stuff by yourself, like because I know that I've only got a certain amount of time in a week. And so I always give myself a really harsh deadline and lock it in with someone else because I know that I won't hit it otherwise. Like, I'm really good at cramming. I was always one of those people that was cramming at school. Like, the test would be tomorrow and I'd be like, holy shit, I better start cramming now. Like, I was always cramming at school.
Yeah.
Always. So
do you need that adrenaline?
I need that adrenaline, yeah. And people always think I do a lot and are always like, you know, think that I'm just always putting out stuff. But it's just like, nah, it's just, let's like down to the wire. Like, I know I've got to release a podcast tomorrow. Like, you know, or I know that I've got to do something, and whether or not there's people waiting for it is another thing. Like, I don't really care about that. It's never been about that. I'm just always like, I'll disappoint myself if it doesn't come out on time. Like, the podcast at least, like, I know if it doesn't come out on Sunday, there will be people. It comes out every Sunday. Where is it? You know, because, you know, people expect that sort of stuff. But when you're making, like, a film or you're making, like, a thing, it is so hard because you don't have anyone calling up and saying, where is it?
Yeah.
You know, which you have in a normal job. Yeah. You have people going, well, where the hell is it? No one's going, I want to see that 4-hour cut of your comedy film. Like, no one's saying that. So it's me going, well, I know I've locked in with a friend to show them a bit of it.
Yeah.
So I know that it has to be at that point by Saturday at 12 p.m.
Is it also that you are a really hard taskmaster in your head?
In my head. Yeah,
do you
yeah.
have an inner critic?
Yeah, I do. I do have an inner critic, and I'm really harsh on myself. And I always thought that when I started doing stand-up, I was always like, oh, I'm my own harshest critic. And then I was like, oh, no, there's some much meaner people out there that were like, I remember once – A friend of mine was like, I was doing a stand-up show and someone came up after it and she interrupted a group of my friends to walk up to me and she said, I just want to let you know I did not find you funny at all. And I was like, I find that very hard to believe. And I like turned back and started talking to my friends. And I was like, well, one of my friends was like, oh, does that happen all the time? It's like, well, yeah, people can be assholes. There are a lot of assholes out there, but I'm way harsher on myself than that person's going to be. Like, I hold myself accountable for everything. And, you know, I swim 4 times a week just because I go, you have to. There's no option. There's no choice. You have to do it. And no one is saying you have to do that.
It's just you and you.
It's just me. It's
You've
just
got
me.
Like a real asshole in your head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's going, you have to actually do that. But I'm way more critical on what I do week to week than anyone else. Like if my diary's not full, I'm just saying to myself, you've really done yourself a disservice this week.
You've let the team you've down, let the Sammy. Whole team what down. The bloody hell are you doing? Yeah.
Team Sammy has
Get in the pool.
Get in the pool. What are you doing? You want to train for the Olympics or not?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And if you're not in the Olympics, well, you're shit, mate.
You're shit. Yeah. You can't live up to that. Yeah. Yeah. But I do have a very harsh critic in my head.
Where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes, not to get too deep, but a feeling of not being good enough. You know, there was always a thing when I was growing up, like I was born with facial palsy. And so I always, it wasn't a choice. I was born with that. And so I always kind of felt self-conscious around people, like always just felt self-conscious. And when you go to, you know, I grew up in the country and kids can be mean about that sort of stuff, you know, that might be surprising, but kids, you know, kids can be mean.
Worst.
Yeah. And so I was always one step ahead of all the bullies. So I was always one step ahead of everybody, like, because you've got to think on your feet real quick. You've got to be like, you know, you've got to make the joke before they make the joke.
Make fun of yourself before anyone else does.
Yeah, before anyone else gets in with the jab. So you're like, I'll go with the grand slam straight away and then they've got nothing. What do you got now? So, you know, so I was always doing that. And then as I started doing things and, you know, I got interested in like film and then just started loving comedy, like, you know, loving comedy. And then I would just write stuff just by myself, like pretending I'd write plays, I'd write anything I could and everything would go in the bin. Like everything was like, well, that's not good enough. That's never going to be.
Start again.
Start again, kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it was always like, because I already felt self-conscious and then I didn't, like I had a dysfunctional family dynamic, I always felt this pressure to work and be better because I don't think, I didn't have that, I had a little bit of support, but my brother is a drug addict and that was quite a tumultuous home life and so I always wanted to get out.
Like, is he older than you?
He's older than me. Older yeah, yeah. So it was like that thing of being homesick when you're at home, so you got nowhere to go. So I would like be 15 years old getting on a bus and going up to the city because I'd arranged to film a sketch with Glenn Robbins, you know, and so I would be filming a sketch. I'd go, one of my friends, we get a bus up from Melbourne and there was a bus at 6 a.m., 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. They were the only buses that went to Melbourne.
Wow, where did you grow up?
Phillip Island. Yeah.
Oh, right.
So it was like, yeah, you only had those buses. And if you missed those, but they're not waiting.
Yeah.
Keith is not waiting.
No, the bus driver. No way.
He's got to get to Melbourne. Can't get there quick enough. So I was always like, well, I've organised to film a sketch with Glenn Robbins or Bob Franklin or all these comedy heroes of mine that, you know, I was just relentless in reaching out to them because, you know, I was just too excited. Like I was like, you know, this is the most exciting thing. And Channel 31 started to play them. So, you know, I was like 15 years old meeting all of these heroes, you know. A lot of them I've stayed in contact with, but, you know, I was, only 15, filming in the city, not thinking about anything else, like, you know, not worried about anything.
About what home was going to be like.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was that nice space of doing things and I've just kept up that weird work ethic from that age where it's like you just have to do it and I've always, you know, I think a lot of my friends who are great comedians and everything, they just don't work that much. You know, like they're geniuses. They get up and they do what they need to do and that's it. And they don't work in the same way.
In the crap. Like the Philippoussis versus the rafter.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like just naturally gifted and kind of get up there.
Yeah.
Rafter slogs it out and then kind of gets over the line.
Yeah, and I'm not naturally gifted. You know, and I knew that from a young age. I was like, I'm not naturally good at comedy. Like, I'm not. And I knew that when I started. Like, you know, it was like I saw people like Fiona Loughlin and Judith Lucy and Greg Fleet who are naturally brilliant, you know. And it's not until you start to go, okay, well, there's two addicts right there that, you know, Greg Fleet and Fiona, two addicts that, of course, they're just brilliant because they're geniuses in that craft. And then, you know, when I got to work with Judith Lucy, which was, you know, an absolute dream come true, I found out that she works fucking hard. You know, and she gets up every day and she writes and you know, and you see all those people like Will Anderson and people like that who you're like, oh, they just work really hard all the time and they never stop working. And I think I'm more of one of those people than the naturally
gifted.
Yeah.
But in the end, I think you can often get further with that work. I mean, Barack Obama says that you focus on the work. Just to quote Barack Obama.
Yeah.
You know, you focus on the work because that's what propels you forward in the end, and you can have all the natural talent. I'm sure there's lots of people who have lots of natural talent and not swimming in the pool four times a week and making documentaries.
Yeah.
Fiona Loughlin and making their heroes at 15.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the thing about some people that you see all these naturally gifted people that do it. And you're just like, wow, I'd love to have that. You know, whatever that is, that spark, that little thing that you're like, wow, you're a genius. Like, you know, to actually look at someone. And I mean, I think it's overused. I think that word is way overused because I know a lot of people that have been called geniuses and I'm like, well, I don't think they are. But there are some people that you're just like, wow. Like to have that brain and to have that.
To be that quick-witted.
That quick-witted.
And just kind of stumble onto a stage.
Yeah.
Particularly in comedy and be half-cut and just create this incredible show.
Whatever it is. Yeah. And, you know, and obviously, like, you know, the geniuses as they get older, it's, you know, they might lose a little bit of that spark they once had. But to see people when they've got it, and, you know, it's so exciting to see people now that you're just like, wow, you've got it. Like, you've totally got it. And I'd rather work really hard for it. But I know that some people who, you know, who kind of rock up and they you know, they kind of just got out of bed and they're like, you're there and you're like, wow, that must be amazing to have that kind of thing.
I wanted to wind it back a little bit, and you can not talk about this if you don't want to.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain to people who don't know what facial palsy is?
Yeah. So it means that people don't have some of the nerves in their face, wherever it is. So they have a lack of nerves. So, yeah, so when I was born, through the forceps that we used, I had a lot of nerve damage on the left side of my face. So it basically means when I smile, I don't get the full lift on the left side of my face. It's not numb, but I am. Lol. No. But it is what I was worried about was that it would droop. Like that was kind of like, you know, it would get worse over the years. But I had an operation that wasn't exactly corrective surgery, but it was to make sure that it wouldn't get worse over time. So it's different to Bell's palsy. Bell's palsy, I think from what I know of it, is that it's often temporary and the nerves stop working for a while. But facial palsy is basically, the nerves were never working or they were damaged at a very young age. So since birth, I haven't been able to smile fully. Like I just haven't been able to do that. And not through lack of trying.
Because you're in comedy.
Yeah. But then just half of my face is just, it just doesn't work.
Wow.
You know, and I always knew that, you know, from it, my mum kind of, I think my mum was very good with explaining it to me and saying that, you know, it's just different. Like it's not that it's weird or, but you know, it makes you feel self-conscious like all the time when, you know, I'm 29 now, but like, you know, before, you know, like growing up and being, you know, in your early 20s and everything. And it sounds like I'm kind of talking about something that doesn't seem to matter that much. Like, you know, I know that people are far worse off and I know that lots of people out there have other things. But, you know, when I was like growing up and you're just not the same as everyone else, like, you know, you feel so self-conscious because, you know, like even if I wanted to be an actor or something, it would always be a thing. Like it would always be an issue. Like if I wanted to act, they go, oh, this character just happens to have facial palsy as well. You know, like he's very good, but his characters always have this sort of droop on one side of their face. They're a bit slanted on one side. And it was always a thing with me where it was like, oh, God. And my mum had read a book. I remember an article about Wendy Harmer. And Wendy Harmer, amazing stand-up who started comedy in Melbourne pretty much, like, you know, Wendy Harmer and Greg Fleet and all these people, Anthony Morgan and all of these incredible people. And Wendy Harmer famously was born with a cleft palate. And her dad pushed her to get up in front of people from a really young age. So, like, got her to perform constantly, and she hated him for it. She hated him for it. But it was about having that confidence always, like about going, you might feel different, so we just want you to get up in front of people and show them that you know, you can be whatever you want to be. And my mum did that with me. So she made me get up and do public speaking. She made me do plays. She made me do all of this stuff. And I remember times when I was so angry at her, like I didn't want to do Toastmasters. You know, who would? I didn't want to go to the Rotary Club. You know, like I, you know,
what's Toastmasters?
Toastmasters was a real crappy. Sorry, it's not a plug on this podcast. Oh, yeah. Plugging Toastmasters, by going, it's crap. It's just a public speaking thing. Oh well, yeah, people might come at you and say it's absolutely not. But yeah, it's like a Rotary Club competition where people would get up and make a speech, like a 7-minute speech. And I remember doing Toastmasters, and yes, I know you didn't ask, but I did go to GIS Toastmasters. And it was, I remember once the improvised thing came out, everyone wanted to be funny. Like, you know, so it could be the most serious thing ever, and you've put together this speech about, you know, Nelson Mandela hero, everyone will go Mother Teresa, and you go, what, really?
Yeah.
You from Warrigal and your hero is Mother Teresa? I don't think so, mate. but everyone would try and do stand-up when they could, because everyone wants to be funny. You know, it's always that thing where I think everyone thinks they're funny, or at least wants to be funny, you know. And so people were like, you know, would just become so dishevelled and everything. I was like, oh, wow, like people, you know, once they're in Toastmasters, like, you know, they can do whatever they want.
Yeah. But the sky's the limit.
The sky's the limit at Toastmasters.
Yeah, opened up all these options.
There's their plug. They did pay me to do that.
But, yeah, exactly. But, thank you to Toastmasters.
Thank you to Toastmasters so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, crappy Toastmasters. But then, yeah, it was like I remember my mum just pushing me to do that sort of stuff. And it was like, wow, if I do it, it felt more normal. It kind of felt like an acceptance thing, as sad as that sounds. It kind of felt like, because a lot of my friends were like, you know, growing up in Phillip Island, the surfers, you know, like it was very beachy,
quite a blokey culture.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think I was just I think I was an odd person. No, I was fucking odd.
But they're my favourite people.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, I was very odd at my school. You know, and I think I was kind of the funny one at my school. But then when you come to Melbourne, you are a very small fish in a very big pond.
Very small, odd, funny fish in a very massive, odd, funny pond.
Yeah. And a little Nemo, Harvey's flipper doesn't really work that well. It's all like me. It's kind of an analogy.
Nemo. Two of Australia's favourite icons.
Yeah, we're very similar, me and Nemo. Yeah, but I think just growing up with that, it's kind of like, well, you have a very different perspective of how other people treat you rather than, you know, I think I always just thought of things a little bit differently because I was always so jealous of people's smiles. And I still am, like, you know, like I one of the first things I notice about people, which is really sad, I always go, God, they've got a great smile. And it's not that I'm jealous of that person now, 29 years old, going, oh, I'm so jealous of your smile. But, you know, I was always kind of a little bit like, oh, like, you know, I wish I had that. You know, I wish I had that because it's such an expressive thing. You know, it's something that, you know, you see someone and you smile and, you know, I had to develop a personality that made people think that I was real friendly because I was like, I didn't have that smile. You know, I couldn't greet people in that way. You know, I couldn't because it would look a bit odd, like, you know, especially when I was a lot younger as well. You know.
Because I wouldn't have even really noticed now.
No, and that's because, like, I don't hide it, but it's I think after having the surgery, it's been a few years of it kind of, I guess, getting stronger.
I see. Like it's like a muscle.
Yeah, it's like a muscle and but it always is still a self-conscious thing. Like, you know, if I was to go on a date or something and, you know, it is, you know, it can be a very big thing for me to still Do it.
Yeah.
If people don't know me or, you know, or I'm meeting people, because I'm a very socially anxious person anyway. So, you know, and that comes from that. So it's like, you know, because of my social anxiety, like to go to a thing with more than two people that I know it takes me a long time to do it, which is why, you know, I always just, it's like the workaholic thing. It's like, just jump now.
Yeah.
You know, before it's really scary. Like, you know, like,
you just have to do it.
Yeah, it's like that bungee. Someone was telling me about bungee jumping. They go, the moment before you jump is the scariest. You know,
and once you're in, you're like, well, I'm falling.
I'm falling.
I'm here now.
I'm falling. It's like, if I pull up, I always make sure I arrive exactly on time and I walk right into the bar or right into the event because otherwise I wouldn't go in. You know, like, and that's one of the reasons I think why I just put stuff out because I'm just like, well, scary now. It's going to be scary in a second. Yeah. So hit upload.
Yeah.
Hit send.
Just do it, Sammy.
Just send.
Do it.
Yeah.
That is so interesting because I think listening to your show and having met you at a social function, I remember I met you at Dave Warnicki's house party. And I just remember
As James
that
says, his 17th birthday.
His 17th birthday. God, he's so fresh-faced. He plays like an intern in your comedy
film.
And it's just so perfect for him because he just looks so, young.
Gorgeous.
Big white eyes. But I remember meeting you there and thinking you were super funny and great and you just seemed so comfortable in your skin. And on the show, on Confessions of the Idiots, you would never know that you struggle with that.
Yeah. And I think it's the people that you don't think a lot of the time that 100% are 100% worse off. I said 100% so many times. I don't know how many percentages go into that.
Say, it was just me in a podcast of Sammy saying 100%.
Yeah, he was pretty good at math, let's just say that. I think it's the people that grapple with it the worst are always the people that I'm attracted to because I'm always like, wow, you're so confident. And I've certainly been with a lot of my friends that struggle with it and aren't as full on as I am in a
funny
an
and like yeah
because
gregarious
because I guess I just always want to include people because I'm always like looking at other people like oh you might struggle with this so I start bringing other people into a conversation and talking and telling stories and everything and I remember once I was dating someone that after a party just went you don't have to do that and I was like what do you mean they're like. You don't have to make conversation for everyone. And I was like, I know. And there's like, you brought out all of your stories. You know, like
you opened I've got your five. Suitcase.
Yeah. I was like, oh, here comes a fucking clown with his props again. But I think because my mum always did it, my mum was like that at parties and social events. She was on a table and she was telling people stories and always such a good storyteller. And I think I saw that and was like, that's just how you are at things. But even though you don't feel confident to do it, you're just like, oh, I've got to be that person. But then when, you know, if it's at a thing like Dave's party, I know that the people are going to be nice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you feel safe, when you're around Dave and I'm like, well, Dave is one of my best friends and I love him. And so I know that he'll surround himself with people who are lovely, you know, apart from Jess Perkins. But, you
know, yes, she's the worst.
I think when you know that you're surrounded by really sweet, lovely people, it becomes easier as the night goes on.
Mm.
And especially like, you know, meeting so many different people that night as well. You know, like I hadn't met a lot of people, you know, I hadn't met you and James and, you know, there's lots of people that, you know, kind of come in and out and you know, it takes a while sometimes to kind of feel comfortable in those surroundings, I think.
Yeah, it's so interesting. What's it like to be the brother of a drug addict? It's a big question.
It just meant that my parents' focus was on him. Because he was difficult meant that I never really had a good relationship with him. Like it was never really an incredible relationship. I loved him, but then, you know, you start to, I think the love doesn't go, but it's like loving someone you don't know. So once they're drug affected, and I think he started quite early, then he started getting violent and there were just so many sort of traumatic situations that happened when I was like 15.
And how old was he? Like,
he was 16, so he's only a year older than me.
So he's so close in age to you.
Yeah.
I think I thought he'd be a lot older.
No, but he went down a different path and, you know, I've never touched a drug in my life. You know, I've always been terrified of drugs. So
you me know, too.
Yeah.
Shockingly, like, having met me.
Yeah, I'm going, goodness. goodness, no, thank you very much. Yeah. I won't be having any of your pot, thank you.
No, thank you. I know someone once said to me, because I was saying how, like, oh, you must have just said no when people had offered you something. I'm like, no one has ever offered
yeah,
you
yeah,
anything.
Yeah. And I don't think, but like, that, and that's the thing, once you get into, like, showbiz.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Everyone's snorting coke. Everyone's, you know, and I've just never done it. Like, I've just never wanted it because I always worried about myself having a chemical imbalance that, you know, one hit of something. That's how not into drugs I am. I don't think everything's a hit. But, you know, Phil got another hit on our hands, everyone. Yeah. But it was like, yeah, I just thought that I might have that chemical imbalance and then all of a sudden I would go down that same path or that I would be an addict or I would, you know, that I would have that problem. So I've just never, I've just never wanted that to affect me in that way. But he, you know, we just had the police around all the time and, you know, and mum and dad had to have restraining orders and then, you know, I had to have that, you know, and you kind of, it's a weird existence where you just kind of, you don't want to be at home, but you can't really be anywhere else because you're like 15. And so, you know, it was just a horrible environment where every night there would just be something. You know, there would be a fight, there would be something smashing, there would be, you know, there'd be violence, like, you know, and you had to deal with that all the time. It was just kind of part of your life and you couldn't really do anything about it because, you know, you couldn't. Like, I tried to stand up to him a few times and it just escalated into a fight. But there wasn't really anything I could do about it, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what's your relationship with him like now?
We don't really have one. Yeah. So we did, you know, tried a little bit, but I think, yeah, you always got a different phone and yeah, never hear from him. Or there might be a nice thing and then there'll be a bad thing and then there'll, you know, so at the moment, at this present time, I don't have a relationship with him. Yeah.
Is that to put a boundary in, do you think?
Yeah. And I'm always drawn to addicts. Yeah. You know, like, you know, I'm always drawn to addicts, you know, so I'm always like, well, I can't, I've got to start to distance myself from those sorts of people, you know, like those sorts of people that are so draining and, you know, a lot to deal with or, you know, or giving them money all the time or, you know, trying to help them or fix them because, you can't really fix people. You can try and so many people do try to fix people all the time but it's never a, you know, it's always it's not a pursuit that I think that you can always go with and always be pushing shit uphill.
Because they really can't get there themselves until they do it themselves.
Yeah,
they have to want to change in them, don't they?
And a lot of people
you can't
don't
do it for them.
Yeah, a lot of people just don't want help.
Yeah,
you know.
I loved Lady O'Loughlin.
Oh, thank you.
I just thought it's a, for those who don't know, you should totally go and watch it. Fiona O'Loughlin, the comedian, Sam made a documentary of her life where it kind of tracks a part of her, I guess, alcoholism.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. And her comedy and really how she came to, I mean, she's brilliant. Obviously, we've talked just before.
Yeah.
How did that come to be?
I met Fiona when I was, I think I would have been 15 or 16 and I was at the comedy festival and I was such a big fan because my mum was a huge Fiona O'Loughlin fan. Like when I was 15, Fiona was the biggest comedian in Australia and she'd made a name for herself overseas and she just was so brilliant. Like her gala sets were like the funniest gala sets and, you know, I always wanted to stay out to watch Fiona on the Channel 10 gala and I saw her at a bar. And I don't know why I was allowed in. I wasn't old enough to be in there. But I remember I had a friend with me and we were filming. We'd filmed a sketch that day with Akmal Sali.
Aww.
And he'd said yes to be on a Channel 31 show. So interviewed him about comedy, did a little sketch with him and then saw Fiona. And I walked up to Fiona and I was like, hi, my name's Sam. I really like comedy and I want to film a sketch with you. And her manager, who's like a really big guy, put his hand in my face and said, we're talking to networks, we're busy. And he, just put his hand in my face and I walked off and, you know, a little bit like,
it's terrifying.
Especially when you're that young as well. And, you know, and I was like walking down the town hall steps and I was real sad. And then Fiona came running after me and she was like, I'm so sorry, darling. What do you want to do? And I was like, I just want to film a sketch with you. And she goes, great. Oh, how about I meet you at the Vic Hotel in an hour? I'm doing a show now, but it'll go for an hour and then I'll meet you there. And true to her word, she finished her show and she walked down to Vic Hotel where I was with a friend, and we were sitting there, and we thought Fiona wasn't going to come, you know.
Of course you did. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't have thought either.
No.
Also, it's so ballsy of you to go up and just talk to her.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And we waited, and you know, Fiona came and filmed a sketch with her, and then I thought that was it. It went on Channel 31, and then, you know, I did not win a Logie or anything that year. Snubbed again.
But then
lost out again. But then, yeah, and then she stayed in contact. She called me once a week and was lovely, and then I made a documentary on her one time when I think I was 18 years old, and I followed her to a comedy show. And I filmed a very short documentary on her, and that went into a film festival. It did pretty well, I think, at the time, and it was called Lady O'Loughlin. And then it wasn't until, 6 years or so later that we had the conversation again. I was like, do you remember when I filmed that thing, and I'd love to make a proper documentary about you? And she was like, yeah, of course. But she had also just been in a coma with a 7% chance of living, and her life was – it had changed so much since then. Like, you know, her addiction was really bad, and it was just like it kind of felt weird to be filming that with a really close friend. And she went to a long-term rehab, and I wrote a letter to her, and I was just like – I think it started with like, new letter, who dis? Of course, classic.
Clever, classic Sammy Fee.
Classic. And wrote a letter to her, and I was like, I really want to make that documentary. And she was like, absolutely. And when she got back to Melbourne, we just started. And I filmed her over 3 years. And it was a story about a good friend of mine who was so big, like such a big comedian, and then had this really public battle with alcoholism, really public, and then had struggled, and kind of found it hard to keep the career together through all of that, found it really hard to actually, you know, get one foot in front of the other. And through failure, getting back up and doing everything she could, we just kept – oh, well, yeah, it was me basically. I had started filming it. Then I took it to a friend of mine, Emma Sharp, and Emma showed it to a friend of hers, Rebecca Holt. Rebecca Holt showed it to Jonathan Brough. And then Jonathan Brough, who, you know, directed Rose Haven, and, you know, he's an incredible director, an incredible person, and he just loved the story. And he didn't know who Fiona was, and he was just like, this is an incredible person on screen, like just has such a presence.
Yeah.
And she does. Yeah. Genius, yeah. And she does have such a presence. And I just started filming her, and one time she was in hospital. She'd gone into hospital, and she said, come and film me. And I was like, oh, my God, like, do you put your documentary maker hat on, Michael Moore style, am I right?
Correct.
Correct,
exactly.
Always Michael Moore.
Louis Theroux.
Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
But, yeah, do I put that hat on, or do I put my friend hat on? And the friend hat wouldn't go on film.
Exactly.
You know, in such a personal space. But she said on the phone that this has to be seen because it's part of it, the relapsing. And so I went to the hospital, and I had my camera with me, and it felt very awkward. And obviously you can't film in a hospital. So, you know, I've got a camera with me, and someone's like, do you have permission to film? And you always go, yes. And then no other questions, no further questions. I'm not taking any questions at this time.
Nothing at this time. Thank you.
But yeah, if you kind of go with confidence into any situation, which is always what I do, you know, you can get through anything, and especially making a documentary. Like, you know, I got kicked out of so many places filming it, but you just keep going, and you just have to keep going, and you can, you know, ask permission later. Like, you know, it's always a good idea. Go ask permission later. Don't worry about that. But then, yeah, it was like 3 years of making it, 3 years of making it, and, you know, a friendship in there as well. And then, sorry, my Siri does not understand what I'm saying. Sorry. I thought my Siri on my Apple Watch would at least be supportive, but no. Still doesn't understand what I'm talking about.
You don't even have a supportive Apple Watch.
No,
let alone just like the person in your head that's just.
Do you know your podcast comes out tomorrow? Oh shit. but yeah, it was just filming and filming and filming, and Jonathan was editing it, and I was kind of going, I don't know if I've got anything left in me. And then also a documentary, there's no ending. Yeah. That's the hardest bit, is finishing something like that, because, you know, I go, oh, great, like I've got this amazing story, but it's not an amazing story if you don't have an ending. Mm. It's just a, you know, like you can't just fade to black and go 6 months later. which is what I did in other things. but I've certainly done that a lot. But, you know, it's so hard. And then Fiona called me and said, I've been cast in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And I was just like, oh, this is the ending. Because otherwise I kept saying to her, I think you might just need to die. Like, I got to that conversation where I was like, I think you might just need to die because we don't have an ending. And she's like, I'll do that for you. If you get this to Khan, I will do this for you.
But that's the kind of friend she is.
Yeah. But yeah, it was just like, what do we do? Like, I don't know how to end it. And then when that call came, and that's why it was 3 years, because a lot of great stuff happened in the first year, in the first 2 years, but then there just wasn't an ending. And then you go, well, wow, this is falling into place.
Was she just struggling with her addiction during that year? Was it, or?
It's a lifelong thing. Yeah. But those few years were her coming out of long-term rehab, which was, you know, I think a pretty critical time to start filming because it was the road to recovery in a very, in a very sad way. It was like, well, you know, it's make or break for her now.
This is the last time.
And also, like, you know, in the industry, it's like, how many more chances are you going to get? Like, how many people, you know, how many more people are going to trust that you're okay and you're doing okay, you know? Mm. And, you know, working in a bar, being an alcoholic, like, fuck. Like, one of the first things that people ask you is, you know, what do you want to drink when you go anywhere? And then she's also got that added thing of people going, well, who's looking after the kids? Mm. You know, because she's got 5 kids. And, you know, it's like, you know, no one ever asks her husband that. But, you know, but for her to be out is irresponsible. And so there's always this thing as like, you know, comedy is very male dominated. That's my opinion. I don't care. Come at me. But you know, it is such a male dominated area. So
what's the attitudes around her, like around that space? If you're a woman who's super talented in comedy, I mean, maybe it's different now, but in your opinion, what do you think the attitude is?
I think it's just a different world now. Like, I'm not in the stand-up world anymore, so I don't really know. But, there's just certain people. It just takes all sorts of people. Like, there's people that, you know, people that still say, I don't find women funny, and you're like, how? Like, it's so intense. Like, you go, how?
Yeah.
Most of the best comedians are female. Like, you know, like, you, it is just the way it is. Like, it's not a question anymore. Like, well, it never should have been a question, but it's certainly not with how much we've progressed. It shouldn't be a question. Mm,
it's interesting. I was interviewing a journalist recently who did a study on heterosexual relationships and men particularly, which is so interesting. And she said that one of the things about comedy is that to laugh at someone is a transference of power, because if you're laughing at someone, laughing at their joke, you're kind of deferring to them and saying, I think you're great, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
And maybe subconsciously there are certain types of men, and not all men, obviously, not hashtag not all men, hashtag come at me, no, that do find that transference of power difficult when it's a female.
Yeah,
you know? I don't know. I thought that would be interesting.
Yeah, look, I've always been very attracted to funny women, like always. Like anyone, you know, that I've been attracted to has been hilarious, you know. And so, you know, but I think that's kind of also me taking a back seat. Like going, you know, because I never want to be the funniest person in a room. Like, I'm terrified of being that person. So I'm just always like, great. No, if you're the funny one, that's great.
That's right. I don't have to take out all my 5 stories and keep on talking. Yeah. You've got the floor
now. You've got the floor. It's yours. So,
yeah, that's
you know,
interesting.
So, but I think, maybe it is a shift of power. Maybe that's the reason that some people find it attractive and some people are terrified of it.
Yeah, because it's definitely happened to me. Jess and I, Perkins, I interview her for this show as well, and she was talking about that in a room. Sometimes she will make a joke and guys won't laugh.
Yeah.
Or they'll look at her kind of puzzled, like, what is she trying to do? Some kind of, you know, I don't know, performing monkey that's like suddenly started talking and everyone's like, you're not supposed to talk.
Yeah.
You know, which is such an old school thing, and I'm hoping that that's really shifted. But I wondered about Fiona and how that impacted her. What's comedy and drugs and alcohol in your experience from that time? Like with Greg Fleet as well, is that a huge issue in the comedy scene?
Yeah, it certainly was. When I started filming, I didn't really know, but I did stand up for 7 years, and it was always at a bar, and you'd always have a drink before and after. You know, a lot of the time, like I started not drinking before because I was like, I don't want that to be an issue, you know, and something that would always be like a tradition that you go, I have to drink before I go on. But some people would. And, I think Will Anderson says in the documentary, he talks about comedy and addiction and how you can be the most charming person in the world. You know, it's always the addicts that are the most charming people in the world, and they can twist and you know, they can make you fall in love with them. And, yeah, it's really charming, but there is that rock and roll lifestyle that is there. And it is those people that, you know, because it's kind of a hit, like that adrenaline hit of getting a laugh is incomparable. And so then you want that all the time and you can't get it all the time. So, you know, it seems to me like, you know, numbing things is the way to do it, like numbing your other experiences, because you're on stage for 20 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, like, you know, like maybe an hour at best, you know, but the rest of the day can be really hard because you're not getting that release, you're not getting that hit, you know, and if you don't have any other things that you like to do, it kind of seems like drugs and alcohol seem like the option, you know, and then you're out late, you're partying, you're out at clubs, you're out, you're doing things, you're constantly working. So it just becomes a huge part of the lifestyle for some people.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Why did you stop comedy?
I stopped because I had a heart condition. So I blacked out on stage one night.
Oh, my God. I was in
a comedy club and I felt really kind of dizzy. My heart was beating really fast and I just blacked out. I just, you know, and, you know, kind of came to and was like, oh, and, you know, just had this audience staring at me, you know, and and then I had to go to hospital and I found out that I've got a thing called SVT, which is it basically means that the two nodes in your heart don't talk to each other. And so sometimes it just, you know, through stressful times, it becomes a problem. And I did stand up after that because I was just like, I don't want that to be the reason I stopped. And I just lost the love and the drive after that. It wasn't like it just didn't seem like a viable thing to be putting myself at risk.
Yeah.
All the time to do that thing. So yeah. 4 nights a week, I was like, do I want to risk that happening again? And do I want this to be an issue? And do I want this to be me? And I started loving making things again. So I was making films when I started and then, you know, did stand up, and that was a thing that I was doing, but I was also doing that film stuff at the same time. Mm. Like I was, you know, always working. So I was working at a film company and doing stand up, and then I was just like, well, I'm just going to focus on the film thing and just do that because, you know, at least I know that I don't have to be out 4 nights a week doing that. Yeah.
What was it like to wake up on a stage having blacked out?
It wasn't waking up. It was like a millisecond of blacking out, and then I just didn't know where I was. Yeah, I had completely lost where I was. So I was staring at a room full of people, but I didn't really know what I was doing.
So are you still standing?
Yeah. I'd kind of fallen because I was grabbing onto a mic stand and I'd kind of fallen, and I was grabbing, clutching onto the mic stand, and then got back up and realised what had happened, but I didn't really know where I was at the time. So I remember looking at the people and They were confused. I think they were thinking, is this still part of the app?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what is
yeah,
this?
Yeah, they'd be kind of laughing awkwardly
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
Wow, did the MC have to kind of come on and help? Or did you cover
Someone
it and
did.
Keep going?
Someone came and helped me. Ryan Coffey, who's a great comedian. I don't think he does it at all anymore, but he was a great comedian. And he grabbed me and took me outside.
Yeah,
he just grabbed me and took me in and said, you need to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But, you know, and you know, at that age as well, people were like, you know, just assumed I'd done a lot of coke or something. Like,
yeah,
you know, it was like,
yeah,
you know.
Because how old were you?
What was it, 3 years ago? I would have been 26 or.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, so. Right in that peak time.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think people just assumed that I'd taken something or, you know, I was just out of it or I was drunk or whatever. But,
yeah,
it was a bit of a wake-up call that, you know, that I couldn't. And also that I was, you know, pushing myself really hard as well. Like I was, you know, always working really hard. So, you know, I kind of thought, maybe working that hard and the adrenaline hit of going out on stage all the time and being nervous before a gig, maybe that's a sign that I need
like
to
stop. It's
like
putting yourself in the line of fire like all the time. It just strikes me, like for someone that has social anxiety and finds that situation kind of scary, meeting new people, and you're just constantly like bungee jumping, aren't you?
Straight into all the fire,
like walking straight
every
towards
time.
It. What is it that you love about making film? Comparatively to the stand-up?
I just think it's more of a relaxed pace. You know, it's a nice thing when you can create something and then, you know, you do one thing and then you go, that's really great and you really like it, and then the edit changes everything. You know, and then you go, oh, my God, it's like solving a puzzle. It's like every time there's like one bit here, one bit there. And then, you know, you're rewriting a whole story, like documentary especially, like you're making a story. You're writing a story as it's happening. Which is pretty exciting, like, you know, when you can actually focus on that and kind of go, well, I'm, you know, writing this story as it's going and this piece goes here, and then you change one little thing and it completely changes the whole narrative. And so I think that's, film is kind of so exciting because the process of it can be pretty agonizing and you know, you can keep filming and while you're doing it sometimes you don't like it and you're like, I don't think this is going anywhere, and then you take it back and you upload it and then you go, wow, this could be something. Or you film a scene that you go, that was amazing, and you get back and you're so excited to edit it. Like, I like the editing more than the filming. But,
that's so interesting.
But, yeah, but you get it back and you're, like, starting to piece it together and, you know, you're making things work, and then you show a clip to someone and they really like it, and so, you know, you kind of get inspired over and over again. And also it's not lost on one night.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah, it's not, and it doesn't have that same kind of immediacy.
Yeah,
because you can, it's there in perpetuity, I guess. It's actually made
there.
A physical thing.
Yeah.
Fraud Festival's really great.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love that. Is that the most recent comedy film that you've
made? Yeah. So that was, completely improvised comedy film.
So that was improvised?
Yeah, the whole
really?
Thing. Yeah.
Wow, talk us through it.
So I had an idea when I saw the Fyre Festival documentary. I was like, oh, I'd love to – I just thought the idea of the Fyre Festival thing was such a good concept for comedy.
Oh, it is so incredible, that story. And
yeah.
What a shit show.
Yeah, like, yeah, just a shit show. Like, how did it happen? How did all the people not stop? And you know, just the idea of a music festival that was put on without any preparation and you know, people were scrambling all the time. And when I was growing up, I loved Christopher Guest films, so like Best in Show and Waiting for Guffman and Spinal Tap and all of those films. And I was obsessed with the idea that they were just improvised. Like, it didn't make sense because, you know, but then you go, well, isn't that better than being written because it's more conversational? And so I came up with the idea that it would be really funny if you had a music festival that was going to be held in a small town, and they're trying to save the small town because a bypass is going through, and they're like,
Cobert.
So they want to save the town, and they're like, well, what do we do? And someone comes up with the idea of having a music festival, but, you know, it's a very small town and they're not going to get any acts or anything, like big acts. So someone comes up with a template anyway, and it says, you know, on the poster it says Lady Gaga, Elton John, all of these big names, David Grohl.
Yeah.
And,
Ryan Shelton,
yeah plays that character.
Up.
Yeah.
It's so hilarious.
And so people are just excited about seeing the poster for the first time, and they accidentally release that poster, and then they sell 40,000 tickets in 38 seconds or something ridiculous, and then they have to put on the music festival. They're like, well, do we cancel it, refund all the money, or do we just go ahead with it? And because the mayor wants to save the town, he goes, let's just go ahead with it. So I come up with that basic idea. So that was the idea. And then I wanted it to be improvised, so I had to write, you have to write like the start, middle and end of every scene, but then you don't put any dialogue in there. So, you know, I always knew where the start and the middle was, and then I wrote jokes that I would tell the people on the day. And if they wanted to use them, they could use them, but that was up to them. And so I then had to go to, there's 22 people in it. I had to go to all of those people and ask them if they would be in it. And that's why everyone's name in it is their own name, because that was the person that I asked to play that part. And getting them to come for 2 hours at a time, I'd film every scene twice. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah, I gave no opportunity for anything else. It was I didn't want to waste people's time because I was giving up their time for free. Like, I didn't have any money to make it. So it was just like, you know, just do it. And then every scene was improvised. So I gave them two opportunities. I went and bought another camera. So I had two cameras all the time, and it was just filming everything. And then I'd get back to the editing room. And
so you were filming it as well?
I was filming it and editing it, yeah, and directing
Sam!
It. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. So I've just, like, made all this noise on my piece of paper.
Yeah,
That is a huge amount of work.
Yeah, oh yeah. God. So, I made it over, it was about 6 months it took in the end. Yeah, so, but that was, you know, going to these people and saying, you know, I'm a big fan of all of these people, and, you know, these people who I asked to be in it are the best and funniest improvisers that I know. So I didn't want to restrict them, but I was like, you know, can you come for 2 hours? And a lot of the people in it were, maybe it was like a 2 hour block. That was it. That's all I had to film with them. But then, you know, the main character, Wes Snelling, Genevieve Morris, you know, there were people that were around a lot more, especially Wes. You know, Wes was around for a lot, and then Genevieve was like, you know, maybe 4 days with her. You know, and you're just trying to piece it together as you're going, and rewriting it as you're going as well, because, you know, when you don't have a budget and you're making something and, you know, you want an epic ending, you can't really get an epic ending, so you have to kind of rewrite depending on what that is. So yeah. You have to, yeah, when you get to it, you're like, well, I can get this space. It's like $500. So I want to spend $500 on this place. And then I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll spend $500 on that place.
Like that big cavernous room.
Yeah, the big cavernous room, yeah.
So it was worth it.
Yeah, yeah. Really, I was like, I just wanted to find a really big space where the festival would be.
And there's like five people.
Yeah, watching the whole show. So filming that and just going, oh, I just want it to be improvised, and, you know, I had lapel mics and I was like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah,
and
that seems to me to be an incredibly stressful thing to undertake.
There were times when it was pretty stressful, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, because I've watched it, and if you haven't seen it, you totally should. It's like, you can get it on Vimeo.
Oh, yeah, I put it on Vimeo.
On Vimeo. But the pacing of it is just so brilliant. It reminds me a lot of The Office, actually.
Oh, right, yeah,
In the way that it's obviously like a faux documentary.
Yeah.
And I know we talked about the fact that The Office is a big kind of influence for you general, the American one especially. Was that deliberate, or was that just something that has come out?
No, just something come out. Yeah, I hadn't watched The Office in a very long time. So I think Steve Carell is just phenomenal. Like, you know, like him in that series is just like, you just see him playing and it just looks like the funnest thing.
Improvising.
Yeah, and he's such a good actor. Like, there's so many layers to him, you know, like, and I'm one of, maybe I'd like to say I'm the biggest Genevieve Morris fan in the world. So Genevieve Morris, when I was growing up, I was like, if I ever get to meet her, my life would be made. You know, like, it was her and her, Fiona, Judith Lucy and Tony Martin were like people that I was growing up just going, if I ever get to meet them. Like, and Genevieve Morris, my mum and I used to just go, how is she that funny? Because it's not possible that someone is that funny. Like, her demeanour, everything. I watched her in Comedy Inc. I watched her in everything. Anything I see her in, Scott Brennan and her used to be in Comedy Inc. together. And I was watching those two and Emily Tahini, and you go, these people are just incredible and on another level. And then you go, why isn't there a vehicle for these people? Because these people are the best people. Like, you know, like, I love being in a room with them. Like, you know, like, they're the funniest people in the world, and there's just no outlet for them all the time, and there should be. And so my main thing when I was like, came up with this idea, it was like, how do I showcase all of those people that I've grown up watching but also have gotten to know over the years, and I find them just the funnest people to hang out with. And I was like, well, what if you just gave them the scene and see where it goes? And people had, maybe had never seen Wes Snelling before play a role. You know, like, you know, he's a cabaret performer, and he, Tina Daltwist is one of the funniest characters ever, but him as himself, he is really funny.
He's, and he's
such a sweet and beautiful person. You can feel that. You can just feel it wherever it is. And then, you know, Genevieve, you know, so when I was sitting down with these people, I was like, I don't want anyone else to do this. Like, this is, it's either these people or nothing. Like Ryan Shelton, people like that. Like, it was like, I actually, when I came up with the idea, I was thinking of you people, and if you can't do it, then I'm not going to do it. You know, like, because there was no, there's no alternative to Genevieve. There just isn't. Like, you know, you could have someone that's kind of like Genevieve and kind of, you know, kind of hits the mark, but there's just looks she gives and, you know, the anger that she has for everyone she meets and, you know, and she's such a strong person.
Yeah.
You know, she's, you know, there's a line in it where Oliver and I, my old housemate Oliver Clark, he's in the film as well, he's amazing, and he plays the MC of the festival. And Oliver and I had one day where we were filming, and it was the first day, and I didn't know really know what it was, but I knew that Oliver was going to hold one camera at our house and I was going to hold the other. And Genevieve and Jim Russell were coming around, and I was such a big fan of Jim Russell. I'd never met him before. He'd never met me before, but Genevieve said, my mate's self-funding a film, come around.
Aww.
You know, and it was just like, and I had one conversation with him on the phone. I'd given him his character, I wrote character bios for everyone. I was just like, this is your character. And then Genevieve and him sat down, and all the scene was that it was Genevieve and Jim talk about their sex life. Genevieve talks about how if you add it all up in time of how many, the period of time she's had other men inside of her, it adds up to this
like
time, blah, blah,
3 years.
3 years. And and she just started. Like she just went.
So that's just incredible.
Yeah. And she was just like, I was just like, that's it. That's all the scene is. And it was her and Jim, and Jim decided that he was just going to be really uncomfortable in that moment, so he doesn't want to talk about it. And I was like, at the end of that, you need to bring up your micro penis. So that was how the whole thing ends. So
and he does this ridiculous thing where he gets
up and he
puts
shows
it between his.
And so that's just those two. And Oliver and I couldn't handle it. Like we could not film it. Like it was, I had to cut so much around that scene because when I wasn't laughing, luckily I get his camera for a second where he wasn't laughing. And. And you have to just keep filming it and go with it. But those two people in a room, it's just electric. And then, you know, and then you have to go, oh, well, yeah, I want Jim to talk about that he sells rocks with googly eyes on them. And Jim decided to say that he's doing a short course at RMIT in just self-confidence, just building up self-confidence. And he just goes on this tangent about self-confidence, and he picks up a packet of Tim Tams and he's like, these are my Tim Tams. They're not for you. They're for me because it's my turn. Just stand up and be proud. And that scene went for 20 minutes and I didn't want to cut anything out. Like, you know, that was the hard thing is that you have to cut that stuff down.
Yeah, and I was just thinking the edit of this is so tight and the timing is so beautiful. It does that thing where it just leaves it hanging.
Yeah.
I just love that so much. There's that funny scene with them in front of the fridge where they're talking about yogurt.
Completely improvised. Like everything's obviously completely improvised.
We have to take this fridge.
But all that scene was, it said Jim wants to take the fridge with him to Coburg. Like to Cobert on a, you know, what is it, a 22-hour drive. And he's just saying, we're taking the fridge, we're taking it. And she's like, we're not taking the fridge, mate. They've got fridges there. They've got, he goes, what does this fridge do that no other fridge does that I've ever experienced? And she goes, oh, no, something about your yogurt. He goes, not yogurt, yogurt. And it just keeps going. It goes, which is my perfect temperature, which is? And she goes, 3.6, 3.4. 3.4, and it just keeps going, and it's just like, so I don't know, and Genevieve and Jim have worked together for so long that their timing, they just know each other so well.
Yeah.
They already know where the other one is going, so it's them getting to play, but them getting to play in a circumstance like, we'd filmed that one twice because I was laughing too much. Like I couldn't handle the intensity of him talking about his yogurt and the, you
know, like, and I could not
it's too much,
that.
You know, but then you know, like, we filmed for maybe 2 hours that day, and so 80% of the scenes that we shot aren't in there because, you know, when I was editing it, it was 4 hours and there were just scenes, little bits and pieces where, you know, I'd be showing it to someone and they'd be going, there's just no point for this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like it's so funny, but there's no point. You know, them yelling at each other in a car park is so funny, or them on the trip, on the road trip down, screaming at each other and him shitting himself. You know, like, it was so funny, but it's like, it doesn't actually add anything to the story and you have to start to cut stuff out. Where, you know, watching The Office growing up, I was just like, it just felt like that was the environment that they got to play in. It wouldn't have been because it was a very commercial, TV, you know, show, NBC yeah. show, I think it was. Like, it would have been so scripted, but it felt like it had that room to play.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I could write a script that felt like it just, I didn't feel like I could write a script that had that playfulness and the I guess that freedom where people look
the
like they're having fun.
Absurdity as well.
Yeah. Someone deciding if they want to crack it at someone in that moment.
Yes.
And they usually
talk about
do.
Yogurt.
Yeah, yogurt.
That's the funnest thing. I guess it's like Amy Poehler, right, talks about. I mean, in Parks and Rec, quite a few of her scenes, I think, had an improv bent to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, I just think improvisation is the most incredible thing to watch. And do you do improv?
No. Not at all. And I think I'd be terrible at it. I just don't have that in me. Like some people are just so good at it. Like, you know, there's Honor Wolf and Patrick Dernan Silver who are in a duo called Hot Department. And just to watch them improvise together is incredible. Like, you know, and they're such artists in the way they do it. I'm just not someone that can do it. But I love to, like, I can go with people on, you know, like, and, you know, like doing a podcast or something, like, you know, I do my comedy podcast and I know how to talk to people, but it's like, you know, but it's not really improv, like watching people.
It's interesting you say that because let's talk about Confessions of the Idiots. Mm. So that podcast is so funny and you do improvise with your guests often when you're reading the story out. Do you want to explain what that concept is?
Yeah, so it's called Confessions of the Idiots and it's about basically a few years ago. So it's now been going for 3 years and
happy third birthday.
Thank you so much. And it was like a year. Before I started doing it, I just had this idea. I just started finding people just kept sending me all these really messed up online confessions.
They're so messed up.
But there's just so many. And, you know, there's all these different websites that just have all of these confessions. And I started reading them and I was just like, oh, it's so weird that they all have this massive build-up that goes nowhere and it's all these people that are just trying to say, I'm actually a really good person. You know, I give to charity and anyway, I shit in a bin. You know, like it's just every confession is like that, you know, and every week you just have these people that. And so I was just like, I just want to record one and see what it's like. You know, and I've always had that thing of I get the confessions, I read them once, and then I don't read them again. I just put them away, and then I bring them out like 6 weeks later, so they're fresh to me. And so I was like, well, I'll just put that away. And then I got my friend, performer Scott Brennan, and Wes Snelling, and I was just like, we'll just sit in a room, and we sat in this very room, and we recorded our first episode, and it was so much fun that we were just crying, laughing, reading these confessions, and you know. It was so much fun to see people getting the idea straight away. Like people just going, this is so funny and you can make fun of these people because they're anonymous.
Yeah.
You know, you can actually go to town on them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and then I just started recording every week and, you know, just getting two people that I find really funny together in a room every week. And they may be well-known people, they might not be. It might be friends that I've had for a very long time or people that don't have a profile for some reason. And you're like, you know, they're so funny. And it's so nice to introduce people to some people that, you know, you've never met before, but you just find them so funny.
Mm.
But yeah, it's great to, it's like my favorite part of the week is getting to, you know, I recorded one just before this and it was like, you know, just getting to do that once a week where you just bring, like all I have with me is my phone. And it's just, I've got four confessions on it and I'm going to read them to two people. Every week.
And that's so freeing, isn't it? Because it doesn't have all of the added layer of like the tech and all the things. It just, you just kind of have this hilarious chat.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's the joy of podcasting. That's what I love doing Suggestible with James, my partner, because we just kind of bring our things that we love during that week and just get silly
ridiculous. Yeah.
And because it's with people that you find funny and you're really comfortable with, then it's just a joy. And I think that's why people love your show too, because they want, you just want to be, everyone just wants to be in a room with people they find funny, yeah, having a laugh.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
at
yeah.
At the end of the day.
Every time. And it's like, you know, once a week, it's just the funnest thing to do, because you go, yeah, oh, and you look forward to it because you're like, oh, I've got these insane people coming this week.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I know that they're going to do what they, you know, they're going to just say what they feel.
Yeah,
and, you know, like,
yeah, what's,
you know,
in their heart, and mostly heart? It's rage,
yeah,
slash it confusion, yeah, and curiosity. What is one of your favourite confessions, do you reckon? Is that like choosing between your children?
Yeah, it's so hard, but there was a confession a little while ago that the actor Stephen Curry is on most of the episodes of the podcast. Like, it's him and Dave Lawson alike on 38% of every episode, like all of the podcasts. But
yeah.
But Stephen and I usually just do it, just him and I, and just because, you know, I've known him for such a long time and we just get along so well that I can say anything to him and he can say anything to me. So there's never a beat,
really,
there's never a moment.
Go there, yeah.
Yeah, and there was one that it was about a guy that was overseas, his wife was sick, he decided to go to a haunted mansion, and while he was there he saw a ghost. She offered a blowjob and then that happened, and then he went home and he didn't tell his wife Susan, and then he came back to Australia.
Susan.
And yeah, and Stephen was just like, you need to follow this up. I have questions. And so I did. I reached out to him on Reddit and then he responded. And so then it's just become this running theme in the podcast where then Stephen will come back and I'll just ask the guy more questions, Dave, and then Dave will then reply to that and just say, it was like, it felt like a vacuum with a water sprinkler in it. And I was just like, wow. Like, because
wow,
he never would have.
So unexpected.
So unexpected.
I was thinking it'd be just cold.
Just cold,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Windy, maybe.
Windy, yeah. Yeah. Windy and a bit of sort of sound effects, like,
yeah.
Woo,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
As it's going.
Yeah, but no, and so that's probably the one that just sticks out, just because there's been so much interaction with it. Like, writing to someone who, you know, I didn't think would respond, because I was like, you know, it's such an insane thing that they put out there.
Yeah, like, is that true?
No.
No,
it's a ghost. No, but I mean, but you know, but
that is was it true, like, for them, or is it like a story? Like, that's what I'm so interested in. Like, do people, do they tell real confessions, or is it
so
for fun?
I think a lot of them are for fun. I think the ones that are real are the ones that have all this bullshit, or there's all this detail for no reason. Yeah. And a lot of it, you go, well, it kind of has to be real. Like, if they're mentioning the colour of the letterbox and then they go on a tangent about how their dad never loved them and stuff, you're like, why is someone making this up? Like, you know,
yeah,
so
yeah,
it becomes, I think when there's way too much detail, I'm usually like, this is definitely,
this is a real,
this is a real
thing.
One. Yeah. And,
yeah,
and guests sometimes say that, like Jess Perkins, who comes on all the time, will be like, I think that one's actually real.
Yeah.
Which is real sad when they find that out. They're like, oh, I think that one's actually
real. Yeah, no, then do you ever feel bad that you're making fun of people?
Not really. No, I mean, they put them out into a space, and internet people are worse than,
yeah,
you know,
anything
the
you
trolls
could ever say.
Yeah.
Totally. Is that a human need, like, if you've done something terrible, to get it out? And if they can't get it out anywhere else, they're like,
yeah,
well, I'll just tell the void of the internet,
yeah,
of, like, millions of people.
I think so. I think if people don't feel they can tell anyone, then they need to get it out and tell someone. And, you know, some people write journals and everything, and some people post on Reddit. It's just such a weird, it's such a weird thing that it's like, nah, I'm just going to
Dear Reddit, these are the most terrible things I've ever done.
Yeah, it's so strange.
Send.
But yeah, 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 send. Yeah, some people are so odd with it that it's like, nah, I think I'll put this online. Okay. And they don't edit it. They just put it up as it is. And you're like, okay.
I love it so much. I could talk to you about stuff for so long.
Yeah, me too.
It's so interesting. I just want to finish with your kind of main philosophy on life, which I know is like a big question.
Yeah.
Do you have like a main driving force behind why you do all the things you do, or a belief system?
I think it's always been, don't let fear be the reason you don't do something. I think that's been the, you know, if fear is the only reason you're not going to do something, then you still need to do it, you know, because I think it stops a lot of people from doing things. It just, you know, that fear gets in the way when they're like, oh, I can't actually do this. I can't actually go through with this. I can't, you know, and terrified, because it is scary. It's like that bungee jumping thing. It's like, yeah, if you don't do it now, you're never going to do it. You just have to do it right now. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. You just have to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when, you know, go swimming and it's freezing out and it's so cold and I swim in an outdoor pool and, you know, and I'm sitting in my car and I'm like, oh, I could just... You just skip it. You know, like there is that moment.
Except for that, that person in your head that goes, like,
no, you get in that pool.
Yeah, buddy, get in there, mate.
Yeah, it's like that. I'm just like, there's some times where I'm just like, oh, I don't want to do it. And, you know, and it's not a fear so much, but it's that thing where it's like you also don't need to do that. And then you're like, well, I'm going to do it.
I'm going to be dead one day.
I'm dead one day. Yeah.
Got to get in there.
I'll sleep when I'm dead. I think that's probably my main philosophy is that, you if fear's the only reason, then just keep doing it. Because
what do you think people are afraid of?
People are afraid of being embarrassed and rejection, I think, is a big thing, you know, being rejected from something, whatever it is. And, and just being embarrassed. You know, I tried and I didn't do it well, or I didn't.
And everyone saw.
Everyone saw, yeah. I think people just have a lot of shame and a lot of embarrassment. And, you know, people who feel embarrassed just, you know, I think it just stops so many people from doing things.
Do you think, in a way, having facial palsy and the childhood that you had is a gift because you don't have to, you've already had all that? You've experienced that and you're like, well, it wasn't that bad. Or you've developed mechanisms to cope with it?
I think so. I think I just don't find anything scary. Like, I mean, I do have social anxiety and all that stuff, but I don't find anything. I know I can push through anything.
Yeah.
Because I know that I've been through the worst stuff in my mind. So I always find that, well, what's the worst that can happen? Like, I don't have an embarrassed filter. I don't get embarrassed. So, you know if I put something out there and someone doesn't like it, then I go, okay. Like, you know,
probably don't like you anyway.
Yeah, it's next week. So, you know, like, you know, like, I've always got something. So, don't worry about it if you didn't like it. That's, you know, it's like a podcast, like doing it every week. Like, sometimes people are going to find it really funny, and sometimes people are going to find it interesting, or, you know, it doesn't always have to be that one thing. Not every week has to be the funniest week ever. You know, you might have so many reasons why the podcast wasn't as funny as you wanted to be. It might be the confessions. It might be so many other things that just weren't as funny as another one you listened to. There's one out next week. You know, there's one. There's going to be next Sunday as well. So, you know, you get a free podcast every week that you're like, well, that one you didn't like as much as another one because you prefer other guests, or you prefer when I said something, or you know, whatever it is, that thing is. It's like, well, there'll be one next week.
Yeah.
I think embarrassment, people just get so worried about what will other people think and the embarrassment out of it all.
Whereas you just got to keep doing it again and again and again.
Yeah.
Because the more that you do it, the better you get at it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not as scary.
You push through the fear. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what, like, you know, when I was making the fraud festival, you know, someone said to me, that's so weird that you're doing it. Like, why would you just do it? And I was like, well, I'm not going to get funding for it. Like, I'm not going to get funding for it. I've always wanted to make it. You know, like, it's that thing of going, do I want a house deposit, or do I want to make this thing that I've always wanted to make?
Yeah.
And that always wins, because it's like, well, even if it gets played, like, it got played on Channel 31, which is an amazing community station, but, you know, COVID hit and I wanted to put it in film festivals, so that never happened. And then, you know, I was like, well, I need to do something with it because it's been sitting there for a year, and I don't think a lot of people would do something like that because they're just like, oh, it's so much money, it's so much time, it's so much thing, and they're going, yeah, exactly, that's why it's so much fun.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's why it's so much fun. What else are you going to do? You're like, yeah, I don't mind if I rent.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I don't like material things. I'm always like, you know, my car is, you know, my granddad passed away. That's the car I have. Like, you know, like, everything I have is like, I don't need new things. I'm just like so excited to be able to do things with all those amazing people. And you're like, well, that's more valuable than
completely
anything.
You don't want to be sitting back in your rocking chair at 80 being well, I'm really glad I had a Mazda 3.
And you know, and people that say, yeah, like, you know, this person that was saying it to me was just like, yeah, what's the point of it? Like, you know, like, you'll put it out and some people will see it and that's it. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, I hope that someone might see it who goes, what, this was completely self-funded? Like, this was all, like, imagine what you can do if you had a budget. Like, you know, like exactly. If someone saw that and went, if this was all done because people liked this person who made it and gave up their time to do it, and then he just went away and, like, I just went away every night, I just edited. Every night I just sit in my room and edit. Yeah, there were times when it was hard, but also, like, if I made one person look at it that would have gone, you know, if someone was in their head going, oh, I wonder why Strawy doesn't make these really funny film like, you know, like America does. Like, you know, the Christopher Guest films. Like, when someone doesn't make a Best in Show, when we have the talent, even more talent with our improvisers and comedians, like, we've got so much talent here. And if an international audience saw that somehow, or someone saw it and just went, that was done without a budget, that's incredible. If it gave Wes Snelling an opportunity that he wouldn't have otherwise have, if it gave Genevieve an opportunity, like, it's just, like, I would love to have a budget to make another one. But, you know, but you just got to do that first, and then if I
see where it leads to the next thing. Because the next, nothing is wasted.
No.
I think no experience, nothing that you've been through in your life that's difficult, if you use it and you learn through it and it pushes you to do something new, it's not wasted.
No.
And mistakes, mistakes are that gift, really.
Yeah.
To keep going, and then you're absolutely right. And because it's a film that lives in perpetuity for in a year, in another, you just don't know what will be the thing that leads to the next thing.
Yeah.
And what an adventure to be on.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? Sit at home in a house and watch Netflix?
Money comes and goes as well. That's the thing. It's like money can be there, it can not be there. Everyone's had those periods of time. It's like, but when you've got it, like I was like that night that I came up with the idea, I bought a second camera.
Wow.
I was just like, I'm just going to do it. Well, I asked one of the people in it to be in it, and I was talking to him about 1 week and got him to say, I'll do it. You know, if I can do it in 2 hours, I'll do it. And then the next week I sent him a date to do it. And he was like, oh, you're actually doing it. I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, 100%. He's like, well, if anyone's going to do it, you're going to do it. But, oh, wow, you're doing it really quick. And I'm like, wow, if I don't do it now, I'm just never, ever going to do it.
Jump in the pool.
Yeah,
to rip the banner. If you think about it too long, it just festers and then nothing happens.
Jump in that pool. Start swimming.
I love it.
For a bit.
Thank you so much, Sam. Honestly, that was such a great chat and so interesting. And I really recommend everyone going to watch Fraud Festival.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, oh, you know, it's an amateur film. I'll have, not an amateur, but I think in my head I was like,
it's just me.
But it's on Vimeo, you know. And I thought, I'll watch it. And immediately I was laughing at the kitchen table, and James came in and he's like, what are you watching? I'm like, you have to watch this thing. I was just...
Oh, that's great.
So clever and great, and just, the cast alone is just spectacular.
Yeah, the best of the best.
Bloody congratulations.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. All right, that's it for me this week. I've been Claire Tonti on Tonts, and my guest today has been Sam Peterson. You can find more from Sammy P at theproducerboy.com, where you can find his podcast, Confessions of the Idiots, and there's links to previous episodes with me and also with James Clement. You can also find his documentary, Lady O'Loughlin, there and watch his comedy film, Fraud Festival, for free on Vimeo. And if you do nothing else, go and watch that for the brilliant yogurt fridge debacle. So hilarious. For more from me, you can follow me on Instagram at Claire Tonti, where I occasionally tell stories. And also there's a link in my bio for my newsletter that comes out semi-weekly. We've had some sick kids this week. So anyway, it comes out semi-weekly, and I'd love to write to you just with updates on what I've been doing and recommendations for things. So that's in the bio down there. Also, if you love this episode or you think someone else would really appreciate it, please share it with them. That would just make my day. And chuck us a rate and review if you like as well, just like the wonderful Tia has. And this is her review. Humour and deep conversations, two of my favourite things. Another fantastic podcast from this lovely lady with a brilliant first episode. Charming, funny, engaging, and so interesting. Hearing people's stories is always fascinating, and knowing that I'm not alone in my feelings about life and all its madness is such a relief. Oh, mate. I feel you too, Tia. It is. It absolutely is. I think it's the only way through, really, isn't it? Life, to know that you're not alone. If you'd also like to write to me, you can write to me at tontspot@gmail.com. And this week I got a really touching email from a lovely bloke called Mattia. He writes about our previous conversation with Jesse Stevens on heartbreak. I identify as a cisgender heterosexual male, and I share some of the ways you mentioned that men process heartbreak. However, I also saw myself in some of what Jesse was characterising as stereotypically feminine. Growing up, I certainly processed heartbreak through verbal expression rather than physical reactions. I do, however, feel that many of my male peers tended to mock or look down upon my showing of fragility. In time, I built a shell and stopped talking about my feelings. And I still found solace in expressing my feelings, but only internally or through writing, or often thinking of myself as a character in TV shows or in books I loved.
Throughout the years, I had the luck and joy of getting to know friends who were fearless and open about their feelings, especially, but not strictly, female confidants, who allowed me to find the room to express and define my innermost hurt and desires. Overall, it took me years to even admit the smallest hurt, let alone heartbreak, and I have to thank my best friend, my wife, and my most recent circle of international friends. So in summary, I'd say that I personally experience emotions in a somewhat similar way as the two of you. That is via words and seeing myself from the outside. However, growing up, I never found a way to voice it to others and I'm still learning. Thanks so much for sharing, Mattia. And I wonder if anyone else can relate to that. I really appreciated you writing in and being so vulnerable. So what a superstar. Okay, that is it from me this week. Sending you lots of love and I'll see you next Tuesday. Oh, that is not a metaphor. That's what I actually meant to say. All right, see you then. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.